Foy Short, A Life in Southern Africa, Chapter 4, Part 2. Foy took the family to the States in early 1967, primarily to visit Allen and supporting churches. He traveled all over the country giving reports on the work in Rhodesia. Margaret wrote Allen while on the road to Arizona to visit the Jean Tope family. She said that after visiting the Topes, they planned to get back to Abilene on Sunday night the 12th, after being in Pampa and Lubbock for two services, then on back to Irving on Monday the 13th. After staying in Irving, they planned to go to Pine Bluff, Arkansas, and then on to Atlanta for a visit with the Bankstons and their return flight to Rhodesia. Margaret was happy to be writing on a portable typewriter that the Dan Clendennings had loaned them and felt quite satisfied to be working on her seventh letter of the day, even though the typewriter, as she put it, skips a bit, and of course the bumps in the road make that worse. Foy and Margaret returned to Rhodesia through London, where they visited with their old friends the R.B. Scotts and the church in Kentish Town. Margaret Scott Daniel once again took Kay and Margaret sightseeing, though Foy came down with a cold, partly because, as he put it, the Kentish Town building was not properly heated. From London, the Shorts flew to Lagos, Nigeria, for a brief visit with Leslie Disselkamp and the Nigerian Brethren. Foy was amazed at the hustle and bustle of Lagos. After talking about the poverty there, he wrote Ellen, "The filth was perhaps even worse than the poverty. Concrete-lined ditches on each side of the road, open to the air, to flies and to scavenging chickens, serve as sewage disposal systems and carried a sluggishly moving mass of human waste. The stench is unbelievable. How the entire population escapes being wiped out by plague or typhoid fever, I cannot imagine. And the noise is beyond belief, too. Everybody talks, shouts, laughs at the top of their voices. Cars roar up and down, each with its hooter going full blast. Even the motor scooters buzz along, adding their shrill beep-beeps to the surging cacophony of sound. And on top of that, the radios. The Nigerian may have literally nothing else, but he will have a transistor radio, and large or small, it will be turned on full blast. You find yourself longing for just a short half hour of blessed quiet." Close quote. After taking a Pan Am flight out of Lagos to Johannesburg, Foy expressed relief to be back in Southern Africa. Social life, raising teenagers. The middle and late 1960s in Gwelo were teenage years for the Short children. Their 5 acres provided space for gardening and livestock. Harold used the jeep to plow and help with other farming chores. Margaret said, "We grew cabbage, so I did a lot of sauerkraut and froze that." They also grew corn. Jim remembered that his parents were active in the school's PTA and very supportive of them and all their school activities. He and Harold played cricket and rugby. Foy and Margaret attended all of their games. Foy wrote rather proudly to Ellen in June of 1968 that Jim was playing regularly for the Chaplin High School's 3rd rugby team and that Kay had made the CJR hockey team, even though she was only in Standard 4 and had to compete against girls in the Standard 5. In the same letter, he reported that Jim, Harold, and Allen went to Salisbury to see the British Lions rugby team play Rhodesia. However, he didn't go because he didn't think it would be a wise use of his money. In 1969, Margaret wrote Ellen about a school play. She said, "Jimmy played the part of the American colonel in Tea House of the August Noon and did very well indeed. His American accent wasn't there all the time, but sounded very authentic when it did come through." Margaret appreciated the fact that school activities in Rhodesia followed a family-friendly predictable schedule. Quote, school was in session between 8 and 1, with one PT period. Everything closed for lunch between 1 and 2, so we brought the kids home for lunch in the afternoons. They went back for any other activities they were interested in, sports, including swimming, debating club, etc. There were no practices or games at night, but some things, like debating competitions, were sometimes held in the early evening. Other activities, such as class parties, took place on Friday nights. Any kind of matches against other schools were played on Saturdays. This meant we could keep regular schedules and have three meals together every day. Close quote. Ellen recalls that her parents, though personally strict in their teaching, for example, they didn't attend movies, allow their children to make choices on attending school activities and parties, even those that included dancing. However, they made an exception when one of her friends in the congregation invited her to a birthday party where there would be dancing. Ellen said, I did not plan to dance, having made the decision that it was not an activity in which I could participate as a Christian, but I wanted to go, especially since a boy I really liked would be there. Mom and Dad told me that I couldn't go, as they felt my attendance would be taken as approval of dancing by them. To help their daughter feel better, Foy and Margaret suggested inviting the same friends to a party at their home. Ellen hated to tell her parents no, but was afraid of what all the cute guys would do when they came to her party and found out there would be no dancing. However, her dad pulled out an ice cream freezer, and all the guys had a blast taking turns cranking it. Then Margaret pulled out the usual games she organized for Friday nights. Ellen said, afterwards, these friends told me that they had more fun than they had at parties with dancing. According to Ellen, supper time was discussion time. We were allowed to make our points and never ridiculed. She remembered that Jim often disagreed with her parents, but that they patiently asked questions that gradually led him to seeing things their way. Many times, Ellen said, Mother got up from the table and took down the encyclopedia to look up something we were discussing. We discussed sports, music, politics, religion, anything of interest. Foy and Margaret's daughter, Catherine, recalled her father's skill with horses. Her maternal grandfather bought a horse for her, so Foy bought one to be able to ride with her. She recalled in particular his skill with a horse named Shadow. She said Shadow had been very badly mistreated by a previous owner and would tremble violently when anyone came near him. Nobody could ride him. Dad rode him home the day he bought him. Within a few months, Shadow didn't tremble anymore, and within a few years had progressed from only letting Dad ride him to letting some children down the road ride him. In thinking of her parents, Catherine said, they have been the most generous, loving, with an unconditional love, and God-fearing parents who taught by example. I have always said that they never had much materially, but in other ways, they are extremely wealthy. The Shorts were active in musical circles in Duello. All of the children learned to play musical instruments, with Harold, Ellen, and Kay becoming accomplished pianists. Harold learned to play the trombone for the cadet band. Jim preferred the guitar to the piano and played the trumpet in the cadet band, although the separation in the boys' age did not allow them to play together. The cadets were similar to the ROTC. The boys' activities not only involved the band, but constant polishing of shoes and preparation of uniforms. Ellen played the violin. Singing was and still is an important part of family life. Ellen ended up majoring in music, and Harold is and has been for many years a member of the London Chorale. Both boys were also excellent song leaders. Margaret auditioned for the Gondoliers, and was a member of the choir for 10 years, participating in various productions such as The Pirates of Penzance and The Mikado. The group did a concert production of The Magic Flute, Vivaldi's Gloria, and Haydn's Creation. There were also numerous popular concerts, and one year, a night of opera in which Margaret sang the flower duet from Madame Butterfly with her voice teacher. She also sang with the Madrigal group. Foy took violin lessons with Dorothy Dams. He said, "She is very critical and adamant on getting the technique right. But, of course, that is as it should be, and I'm thoroughly enjoying it." Foy played golf in Guelo after being introduced to the game by Harold in 1964. He wrote his children, "My golf is improving steadily. Yesterday afternoon I played a round and had a score of 81. I'm expecting to be out to 12 handicap any time now, as I've had two good rounds in succession." One of the members at the Guelo Club, a Mr. Bedingfield, told a Mr. Smith in front of Foy, "You know, Foy is having a very marked and beneficial sobering influence on the Guelo Golf Club. The men are taming their language down and their topics of conversation. The atmosphere is becoming more pleasant." Foy seemed somewhat unconvinced when remarking to Ellen, "I've never rebuked any of them for bad language. It will be interesting to see how far this influence extends." Foy and Margaret were active in various clubs and benevolent groups during the Guelo years. Foy was chairman of the Cancer Society, and both were active in the Caravan Club, with Margaret serving as secretary. Later, they became members of the Rotary Club. Foy served as president in 1978. Early during his stay in Guelo, Foy went to a game reserve to hunt for eland, a giant antelope. When he started to cross a clearing, he heard a rustling sound on the side of the clearing and instinctively stepped back into the bushes next to the clearing and squatted down. Out into the clearing stepped a large Cape buffalo bull, considered by many to be the most dangerous animal in Africa. According to expert David Meisel, lone bulls are very nervous as they don't have the safety and security of numbers and are therefore very quick to charge at any sign of danger. A charging buffalo, he said, is difficult to stop, and many hunters have fallen victim to them even after shooting warning shots. The huge beast sniffed around, caught Foy's scent, and started walking towards him. To Foy's horror, he realized that he had soft-nosed ammunition in his gun, which would be completely ineffective against the behemoth. He quickly loaded 2 hard-nosed bullets into his weapon, but the buffalo heard the clicking sound of the reloading and stopped about 20 yards from Foy to try to determine where he was. One shot is often not enough to bring down a Cape buffalo, and Foy decided he had better try to get off a shot quickly so that if the animal charged after the first shot, he would at least have one more hard-nosed bullet to try to save himself. Foy, in a squatting position below the buffalo, aimed for the heart, fired, and the enormous animal collapsed in a heap. It was a perfect shot, going through the heart and severing the spinal cord. Foy said modestly, "I was lucky." Foy also loved to fish for bass around Bulawayo and Guelo, often with Dennis Clark, but especially enjoyed traveling occasionally to the Zambezi River, where even more challenging game fish awaited him. A large mounted tiger fish with razor-sharp teeth that Foy caught on the Zambezi River decorated the wall at his home in White House, Tennessee, until he moved into his daughter Kay's basement. Letters. After the older children left home, Foy and Margaret frequently wrote them, giving advice and reassurance. Sometimes the letters dealt with trivialities of life. Margaret, wrote Ellen, be sure to buy your clothes at Sears as much as you possibly can so that you can use practically all your other money for other things. More often than not, the letters dealt with important challenges their children were facing. They were always very personal, affectionate, and full of little pearls of wisdom. Typical is what Foy wrote Ellen in 1967. Quote, we seem to stay awfully busy, but I'm old enough to know that life is so short that we'd better make time for things we really want to do. So, I'm writing this even though there is a stack of slides to get ready for the show and a stack of books for sermon preparation all staring me in the face. I want you to know that you rate higher than all of them put together. In December of 1969, he wrote, you are in our hearts and minds at all times. How we wish we could do more for you, but perhaps it's better for you that we cannot. It never ceases to amaze me how our quiet, retiring, unsure little Ellen was able to leave home in her mid-teens and cope with life the way you have done. Everyone speaks of how well you have coped and how mature you've shown yourself to be. Regarding Ellen's romantic ups and downs, Foy advised her, just get as much emotional experience out of them as you can. Take the joy, the pain, the bewilderment, the anxiety, the beauty, the disappointment. Learn from them all. They are the experiences of which life is made. Learn from them, and you'll learn to evaluate situations properly and be able to keep things in the proper perspective. Then one day, you'll make the right choice for life's mate. Just make haste slowly in these things. But there, I can't even write a letter without preaching. Sometimes the letters reveal that times were slightly lean financially. When advising Ellen to be as frugal as possible when she was short on money, Foy admitted to her, Mother and I have mostly had the same experiences throughout our married life. Things are a little easier now, although we still have a crisis now and again. Back in January, we had to get an overdraft from the bank, which we're still paying back. For one thing, two churches have dropped our support, leaving me $75 per month short, and no one has taken that up yet. In other letters, Foy wrote philosophically about their lives. Quote, the other day, Mother was talking about how many things she wanted to get done that she never seemed to get around to. And I have suggested that in our lives, it must always necessarily be so. We have so many and so varied interests that our problem has never been in finding something to do, but rather in choosing which things to do first. Consequently, many things have to come later, if time for them can be found at all. So, I fully expect that when my time to die shall come, I will leave behind quite a list of things that I would have liked to have done had time sufficed, which is just another way of saying that our lives are full. What I try to concentrate on is to do all that I can to see that they are filled with worthwhile things. Camp Nguelo. Foy and Margaret started up a new camp for young people in the area, in a place called Whitewaters Dam. They were able to run the camp there until 1968, when the Bush War began to make it too dangerous to operate. Typically, 50 or 60 young people would attend the camp, and there were usually a number of baptisms. Though the camp never became as large as the one in Bulawayo, Patty Kendallball felt that it accomplished much good. Jim remembered how much he enjoyed his father's Bible classes at the camp. Foy's father, W.N., or Will Short, wrote about Foy's camp at Nguelo, as well as several others in southern Africa. He said, The Lyons family, with helpers, with 28 children present, had such a camp near Lusaka, northern Rhodesia. H.F. Short and helpers had 30 children near Gwelo, while C.H. Bankston and others had 64 children out from Bulawayo, southern Rhodesia. Ellen recalled the primitive conditions at the camp. Dad would take a 55-gallon drum, cut it in half, and put it on sticks. In the early morning, you would go out and get water and pour into that drum and wash. That was our bathing facility. The boys had their own drum in another area of the camp. Our toilet was a ditch with a grass enclosure around it. It was real camping. Jim remembered having to dig the latrines every year before camp and then fill them in after camp. "Great fun," he said, with a bit of sarcastic humor. He also recalled that two young boys, whose father was active in the Presbyterian Church, attended camp. One year the boy's father said that the youngest son, David, returned from camp and asked him, "Do you think that Jesus knew as many scripture verses as Mr. Short?" Jim added with understatement, "Dad quoted scripture frequently." Foy also encouraged the children at camp and his own children to memorize scripture. Foy occasionally felt the need to reinforce the fact that though the camps did some spiritual good, the recreation and games in them took them out of the realm of church work. They therefore should not accept church contributions. Most of his weekly bulletin of April the 13th, 1972, was dedicated to analyzing this point. A family challenge. The middle and late 1960s were a challenging time for the Shorts because of growing differences with their older son, Harold. He attended college in Salisbury and was confronted with the unbelieving professors and the political turmoil that characterized universities in that decade, not only in the United States, but throughout the world. Harold was convinced that far-reaching changes were needed in Rhodesia, while his parents were more concerned with maintaining law and order. This led to family disagreements. While trying to cope with agnostic professors at college and differing opinions about social change with his parents, Harold also had to deal with brethren from the Norway mission who often expressed their displeasure with his father's refusal to go along with institutionalism. They told him that he wasn't thinking for himself, but only believing what he did because of his father. That was exactly what he had been told many times at the university. The Americans from Norway mission also reminded him that his own grandfather didn't agree with them. According to his brother Jim, Harold also became discouraged when he observed the ungodly attitudes that surrounded the controversy about institutionalism in southern Africa and the United States, and the racism that characterized too many brethren in both places. All of these challenges proved too much for young Harold. He stopped attending worship services, married, and moved to England. How many others like him from the 1960s began to see primitivist Christianity as a source of petty squabbling instead of a fountain of love and peace in a shallow, materialistic world? Ellen felt that her parents often second-guessed themselves for Harold's abandonment of some of their convictions. She said, "They felt they should have been more in contact with him during that critical time." Foy participated in a panel discussion on foreign evangelism at the Eastside Congregation in Athens, Alabama in 1971. An unknowing and unthinking questioner asked Foy, "When you go overseas, what about your children? Isn't it possible that some of them could have problems?" There was a long, uncomfortable pause, especially for those who knew of Foy's situation. His eyes watered and he said slowly, "In any war, there will be casualties." Perhaps thinking of Harold's spiritual challenges, Foy confided in a personal letter to Ellen in 1970 about his decision to raise his family on the spiritual frontier. Quote, "Frontier life is a lonely life, full of hazards. But somebody must face them, or no frontiers are conquered. Was I wrong to expose my family and my children to these hazards? And if there are casualties in the frontier battles, does that mean we should all have stayed where it's safe and avoided the casualties? If the Lord will allow it and sees fit, I purpose to continue to battle on the frontiers of the gospel." Of course, spiritual casualties can occur anywhere, as one elder in North Alabama reminded Foy and Margaret. Margaret recalls wondering out loud with him whether she and Foy should have returned to North Alabama. So, as she put it, our children could have attended Christian schools. The elder confided to them that the same type of thing had happened to his family, even though they lived in Alabama. They had two sons. Both had attended the Bible school in Athens from the first grade to the 12th, and then gone to a college run by brethren. One continued to work among known churches of Christ. The other chose a different course in life. Foy and Margaret maintained a good relationship with Harold, who became highly proficient in computer publishing programs. As will be seen in the last chapter, he dedicated much time to help his father publish the Bible Concordance in the Assiniboine language. Bush War in the 1960s and 1970s. Political instability would affect Foy's work beginning on November 11, 1965, when Ian Smith and his allies declared independence from Great Britain so that they could continue a more gradual path toward majority rule, even as Britain and the Nationalists demanded drastic changes. Shortly afterwards, Shona guerrilla forces trained in China and led by Robert Mugabe, and Russian-trained forces of the Amandabeli tribe, led by Joshua Nkomo, began attacks on the Smith regime and on each other. Though Foy and other evangelists of European extraction endured inconvenience, especially in their travel, the ones who suffered the most were the Africans in the rural areas where competing groups of guerrillas rampaged. Foy describes some of the difficulties in the late 1960s and 1970s. Quote, "During that period, the violence also spread to the cities and along some of the main roads, so we had to open bags for inspection at every building we entered and could only travel to some of the main roads in a police convoy. We had to assemble at a point at the edge of a city and would travel with a police Land Rover at the head, another halfway back, and a third one at the end. Sometimes the convoys were attacked, but you were much safer than going it alone. Many missionaries were recalled during that period, including some of our own, mainly those in the more dangerous border areas." Close quote. Because of the growing violence in the 1960s and 1970s, Foy and other evangelists were often unable to visit congregations in rural areas. Foy's paper had to do much of the teaching that he had done earlier in person. Foy lamented the passing of the peaceful Rhodesia he'd known as a young man, where he was often able to camp out in the wild with no concerns. In writing his children, he described, quote, "Camping out in or near tribal trust lands in the evenings, especially with the cattle lowing, children laughing, African voices calling, talking, mostly at their uninhibited loudest, tentative throbbing of drums breaking in now and then, as if testing themselves for the evening's performance, and in the west, the sun sinking in a bath of blazing yet softening reds, blues, greens, gold, and every shade in between. And you could almost believe you were in the land of make-believe, so beautiful and peaceful and satisfying, it could only exist in your imagination. This is the Rhodesia I grew up in, and so did you, children." Close quote. However, Foy realized that the peaceful, idyllic Rhodesia of his youth was about to change forever. Quote, "But as all living things must change, grow old, and give place to the new, so I am persuaded must Rhodesia and her peoples also change. Looking at the nations and peoples of the world around, I fear the changes will not all be for the best. With advocates of nonviolence bombing and machine gunning those who won't agree with them, and the purges of corruption merely making way for their own brand of corruption, etc., I'm forced more and more back upon the only living way, the only answer to man's needs and problems, the way of Christ." Close quote. Even before 1965, there were signs of growing instability. In the early 1960s, one of Foy's heroes, Fazo Shandavu, had a frightening experience when a group of revolutionaries knocked on his door asking him to show his party membership card. He replied that he didn't believe that a Christian should be a part of the party. The political thugs replied menacingly that he had 7 days to get a card and that if he didn't, he would be killed. Shandavu's wife and children begged him to obtain a card, arguing that it would not necessarily mean that he believed in violence, but he was adamant, not wanting to sympathize in any way with political intimidation. The family knew that this was no idle threat, as others had been assassinated by political thugs. After the 6 day darkened into night, the government banned the party, police arrested its leaders, including those who had threatened Shandavu, and therefore they couldn't come to his home and carry out their threats. As the Bush War intensified, most African brethren continued to serve God at great personal risk. Though told on occasions by the guerrillas not to meet for worship, most did. Several died for their faith. A young man named Douglas Simbanda was bayoneted in front of the congregation where he was preaching. Foy told of the persecution that his good friend Jeffrey Nyembezi had to suffer during the period. Quote, "During the Bush Wars, the terrorists sent word that there would be no church meetings because they looked upon the churches as a possible source of resistance to them. Jeffrey continued to meet with the brethren. Also, the guerrillas wanted them not to pay taxes to the government, but to them. Jeffrey said, 'When you're the government, I'll pay taxes to you.' For that reason, and because he continued to preach, he was number 3 on the list of men they were going to assassinate." Close quote. One day, Nyembezi left his wife, Maina, at the house while he went out to visit a man whose father had passed away. While he was gone, a band of terrorists barged into his home and, finding only Maina at home, asked her where her husband was. She knew that his life depended on her not telling them, so she refused to divulge the information. They then began to beat her brutally to try to extract the information, but she refused to tell them anything. Finally, she was beaten so much that she slipped into merciful unconsciousness. When Nyembezi came home, he found his wife unconscious in the front yard. Foy said, "The nearest medical facility was about 25 miles away, and he had only a bicycle. He put his wife on the seat and started pedaling there. He said that all the way he was praying that he wouldn't find any more terrorists." Ellen Bays talked with Maina about this horrible experience when visiting her in October of 2010. Ellen said, "That was quite an experience listening to her tell the story. Wow, I've always thought she was a very good person, but now, how many of us would have her courage and love to endure what she did for love of her husband and the gospel?" As the war was winding down, Foy was thrilled to find out about a congregation in the Matobo area of southern Matabeleland, a center of violent guerrilla activity that continued to meet faithfully throughout the perilous period. The main teacher in the congregation was Samuel Mpofu, who only had about a fourth grade education and had been a plodding student in some of Foy's extensive Bible classes in the 1950s and 1960s. However, Foy realized that he was the kind that sticks, truly a soldier of the Lord who stood fast at his post regardless of hazards. As news began to trickle in about how they survived the war, the story was told about their worship services being interrupted one Sunday by guerrillas. The following conversation ensued. Guerrillas: "What are you doing here?" Christians: "We are worshiping." Guerrillas: "Whom do you worship?" Christians: "We worship the one who cannot be seen." Guerrillas: "How can there be one who is unseen? We'll shoot this one you speak of." Christians: "How can you say such a thing? The one we worship made all things. He made you and gave you the brains to make and use those guns. How can you shoot such a one?" Foy said, "At this, the guerrillas laughed and went away, saying they did not think such people could harm them." However, he added, "Not all such confrontations ended so easily." Foy wrote about two congregations in Matsholomotoshe and Dadata who were left with only women during the Bush War. He said, "They sang, prayed, read the scriptures, and partook of the Lord's Supper. Perhaps one would give an exhortation. When peace finally came and I was able to visit them, they were quietly assembling as the Lord commanded. They offered no complaints, voiced no pity." Foy often expressed to others that women were often the key in maintaining many rural congregations during the Bush War. He said, "During the early 70s, there were times when women kept the work of the church going while the men were forced to leave the villages. Sometimes the women had to meet secretly under the cover of darkness. It was a dangerous business." Though women in the Amandabele and Shona tribes were by nature submissive, they often had an inner strength that surpassed that of their male counterparts. They were a primary factor in the strength of the kingdom in Zimbabwe. Summary of the work in Gwelu Ngweru. Foy and Margaret felt that their English work in Gwelo was successful in terms of the number of conversions to the Lord. However, Margaret felt that it was a difficult place in many ways. It was a transient place where people would stay for a few years before being transferred to another place. She said, "The congregation would build up for a while to 50 or 60 members, and then a lot of people would move away all at once." By the time Foy and Margaret left in 1979, there were a few families who held things together in the English-speaking congregation. Commenting on those frequent departures of those baptized into Christ in Gwelo, Foy said, "It seems that most of them remained faithful wherever they went." George Eady, though not a public speaker, was a very solid leader in the congregation in the years after the Shorts moved back to Bulawayo. Paddy Kendallball reported in February of 2010 that George Eady accompanied him on a trip to Goko, and that though he was in the medium stages of Alzheimer's, he was still able to converse in Shona or Isindebele and was highly respected by the African brethren. Foy confided to Ellen in 1969 that his reports from Gwelo were never spectacular. Quote, "I've never been able to make breathtaking reports, the kind that make the whole brotherhood sit up and talk. But I don't worry about that, and I'm certainly not complaining. Over the years, it does seem that God has been able to use me, and I can truthfully say that wherever I've worked, the church has grown. It just seems to take me a long time to get the job done." Close quote. What Foy didn't realize at the time was that much of the good he accomplished was done indirectly through those he trained. Though he perhaps didn't personally baptize a large number of people, those he taught did. Among the Amandabeli in the area, many of his students, such as his protege Enoch Nubi, started a number of congregations that have continued to grow well into the 21st century. The African congregation, started by Nubi and others, have been Foy's longest living legacy in the area around Gwelo. End of chapter 4.